Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today on our series, I've always wondered, the price of gas. What is it with 0.9 cents anyway, right? Pentagon budgets as well. And beer, really expensive beer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Risdahl. Glad you're here, everybody. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 24th of February. It's a Monday, and the number of the day today is 520,000. That's denominated not in dollars or gallons or percentages, but in people. It is, give or take, the size of the United States Army right now. And according to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, that is too many people. The White House is going to send its budget to Congress next week. Today, Hagel unveiled his bit of it, Army, Navy, and all the rest. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going with the Pentagon's personnel problem.
Secretary Hagel says we don't need a huge army now that we're not fighting two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He wants to cut the army by 13% to as few as 440,000 soldiers, enough to fight just one war at a time. Todd Harrison is a military analyst at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says the Pentagon wants to turn away from the Mideast.
It's a pivot to the Pacific, but that means a greater emphasis on air and sea power and a downsizing of our ground forces.
The Obama administration wants a more nimble military that relies more on technology. Lawrence Korb is a former assistant defense secretary. He says that would mean fewer infantry jobs, but more drone pilots.
The Air Force has got more drones now than it has regular combat aircraft. Even the Navy's starting to put drones on their aircraft carriers.
So fewer troops with less generous benefits. The Pentagon wants to lower housing allowances and subsidies for grocery stores on bases. Gordon Adams teaches international relations at American University. He says that won't go over well with service members and their representatives.
So you've got individual members of Congress who are being hammered by constituents, and members of Congress are understandably sensitive.
Asked about the politics today, Secretary Hagel said Congress had to be sensitive to the fact that we're facing a new reality of relative peace, but not enough prosperity for the huge armies of the past. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said today the United States is prepared to send aid to Ukraine to help it get back on its feet economically. The IMF and others are going to have to chip in as well, Carney added. But in the meanwhile, there are real questions about what happens next on the ground. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Peace has returned to the Ukrainian capital, but the country is still in the grip of a deep economic emergency. Nick Redman of the International Institute of Strategic Studies.
The budget coffers are nearly bare. The gas bills are rising quite dramatically. Foreign exchange reserves are quite low. The currency is under pressure. The current course is untenable.
Ukraine needs help. Russia promised the Yanukovych government assistance in the shape of a $15 billion loan and cheap energy. But it's denounced the revolution as a coup. And after ponying up $3 billion of the package, it now says it wants to know more about the new government's economic plans before handing over more. David Dalton is with the Economist Intelligence Unit.
That doesn't look very promising for that they're going to carry on handing over the money.
You think it is possible that the Russians will cut off the cash and scrap the energy deal?
Very possible indeed.
The US said today it's ready to give financial support. The European Union and the International Monetary Fund have stepped up too. There's talk of a $20 billion bailout, but with strings attached.
The main thing is that Ukraine needs to reform, and that's what it hasn't been doing for the last 20-odd years.
Ian Bond of the Centre for European Reform says Ukraine may have to scrap fuel subsidies, tighten controls over public spending, and shake up its system of governance.
These are all, I think, rather familiar things from the Eurozone as well.
Ukraine could soon be getting a foretaste of the tough medicine the EU and the IMF prescribe when helping countries stave off default. With that in mind, the White House said today, our help will make Ukraine's reforms easier. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back home at the corner of Wall Street and Broad, strong start, slightly less strong finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You You know how there's been this fight for like years over something called net neutrality? The idea that the companies that own the internet pipes can't just choke off the content they don't like because it takes a lot of bandwidth? Well, the FCC is working on rules. There's been a strong lobbying push by content providers. There has been lots going on this subject. And now there is Netflix, movie streaming, heavy data using Netflix. It made a deal with Comcast over the weekend to pay to keep its stuff flowing freely. Tip, quite possibly, of the internet iceberg, as Sally Herships reports.
This battle has been going on for a year. Before the Comcast spat, there was the standoff between Netflix and Verizon. Sam Rosen is an analyst with ABI Research.
So Verizon said, hey, Netflix, pay us for the traffic you're pushing over our network. And Netflix said, hey, you know, maybe not.
Today, Verizon's CEO said, in light of the Comcast deal, Verizon expects Netflix to start paying it directly. Rosen says Netflix is outgrowing what's called the content delivery network, paying middlemen to help get you your House of Cards or 30 Rock reruns. Now, Netflix will pay Comcast directly.
Just as Walmart has started to take over a lot of their own shipping because they can do it more efficiently in some cases than their smaller suppliers. Netflix is basically doing the same thing.
Rosen says while we don't know how much Netflix is paying Comcast, he thinks consumers won't get hit with a bigger bill. It's likely Netflix is getting a better price by cutting out the middlemen.
So maybe our bills will go down?
I wouldn't expect your bills to go down.
Rosen says Netflix was paying middlemen about 40 cents a month to stream each viewer's video. Michael Hodel is a telecom analyst with Morningstar. He says the deal is more about quality than price.
If anything, this would be good for consumers in that it'll improve the performance of Netflix content to Comcast's internet access customers.
But Hodel says no matter how you cut it, Comcast is holding a lot of the cards, and it could be tougher for companies to negotiate in the future. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Technology, as we've all seen, has been a huge factor in some of the big protest movements over the past couple of years. Twitter in Tunisia and Iran and Egypt, Facebook as well. And now apparently an app called Zello, which has been used widely in the Venezuelan protests the past week or so over rising prices and shortages of food and medicine there. We've got the co-founder and CEO of Zello, Bill Moore, is on the line, and he's going to explain what it is and how exactly it works. Hey, Bill.
Hey.
Tell me about this thing. It is basically a walkie-talkie, right?
Yeah, Zello is a walkie-talkie app. Did you play with walkie-talkies as a kid?
Of course I did.
So that functionality is an app.
How did you find out that it was big in Venezuela? What happened?
We pay careful attention to our market rank in different countries, and so we noticed that Zello was a number one overall app ahead of Twitter and Facebook and everything else in both Venezuela and Ukraine last week. And we had seen the same phenomena last year where it was the number one app in Egypt and in Turkey before that.
And it kind of puts an interesting perspective on this because it is now you, private company down in Austin, Texas, versus the government of Venezuela trying to shut you down.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's probably the case we're in. And I guess what we have going for us is technology often always wins, I guess. That's our history so far.
Has to be said, this is a business opportunity for you, isn't it?
Well, Zello is social radio. We're trying to make it simple for people to communicate with what they know best. There's 53 million users who have registered for Zello around the globe, and the vast majority of those use the free app. We also sell for businesses a subscription where they use it to replace two-way radio for a private network. So the publicity certainly helps. It's unfortunate it's in this situation. But it's not going to directly impact our revenue.
Does it give you pause at all, or I guess would it give you pause if the bad guys, whether it's drug dealers or somebody else or governments trying to shut down protesters, if they started using your stuff?
It does, and it's a two-way street, and it's an old problem with communication that it can be used for good and for bad, and there must be bad guys that use Zello for communication, and occasionally we hear from the FBI or a government who needs help, identifying these people. We're not able to provide much help because we don't save much information, but it's a tough problem.
It's not like, say, Twitter or Facebook or phone companies where you keep, user data and all that stuff?
We don't keep any user data, and that's one of the reasons why is to, avoid these problems.
Bill Moore, founder and CEO of Zello. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Guy.
We get that there are things in business and the economy that just don't make a whole lot of sense. Believe me when I tell you we get it. That's why we came up with a new series where you guys ask the questions and we get one of our reporters or producers to answer them. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Turns out a whole mess of you have been wondering about the price of gas, how it gets set, and how much control gas stations have over it. Today's lucky winners are listeners Dave Rogers and Rick Pelton in Marketplace's Tommy Andres took them in search of the answer.
So I've got Rick and Dave here, and we're going to hop in my car and go on a virtual trip down south.
Sunshine, lollipops, and...
whose CD is this? Our first stop is a gas station in Georgia, where we meet this guy.
My name is Rob Ward.
Rob owned and operated this very gas station for 17 years.
From 1990 to 2007 in Atlanta.
Rob, our listener Dave Rogers has a question.
How do gas stations know when to raise or lower prices? I picture Big Oil calling you up and saying, raise your prices 10 cents, and then hanging up.
Oh no, they're not allowed to suggest prices. They send you a fax every day of your cost, and you base your price on your competition.
Even though a good-sized gas station can sell a 250,000 gallons of gas a month, the margin on each gallon is really low.
And it's probably 4 to 5 cents now, or maybe less.
Stations make most of their money on cigarettes, soft drinks, and lotto tickets. It's all about getting customers into the convenience store. But the bait is the cheapest gas price.
Margins actually tighten when the gas prices go up.
Back when he owned his station, Rob would drive around scoping out his competition every day. But he only cared about one thing.
Stations which are on the same side as you, because typically roads are either evening traffic or morning traffic.
You could be across the street from another gas station, but not really be a direct competitor with them because of how traffic flows?
Correct.
Rob says a median might as well be an international border. But for stations on the same side, a carefully picked price can make all the difference to customers.
If you dropped a dollar in the trash can, you wouldn't care about it, but you're not going to pay 5 cents more per gallon.
Thanks, Rob.
To answer our next question, we're off to Three Lakes, Wisconsin, where this time of year, all three of those lakes are frozen.
Rainbows, everything that's...
Man, what's wrong with this thing? Our destination, the Northwoods Petroleum Museum.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to the museum.
That's Ed Jacobson, also known as Jake the Oil Guy for some reason.
Tommy, the name Ed is a terrible name. It's one syllable, it's hard to pronounce, and I've always been known as Jake.
Ed worked for Esso, and then he bought up half a dozen gas stations that he ran for decades.
So I left the business, and I missed all this stuff so much, I started buying it back. And it just got to be a collection out of hand.
Ed runs his free museum just for fun. He's got everything from derrick drill bits to vintage gas pumps to antique oil company freebies.
The museum houses at least 4,000 items.
Ed, Rick's got a question for you.
Why do gas prices end in 0.9 cents?
Yeah, we have to go way back to where the oil companies were selling gas for, let's say, 15 cents. And then the state and the federal taxation boards decided they wanted a piece of that to keep the roads going. And so they added 0.3 cents. And the oil companies and the dealers said, well, we're not going to eat that. You know, we're going to pass that on to the public.
Raising prices a penny would have been disastrous when gas was only 15 cents. But why did it stick around?
And they found out that if you priced your gas 0.1 cent below a breakpoint, let's say 40 cents a gallon, 39.9 just looked to the public like 39 cents.
Now, you won't find 0.1 cent on your credit card bill or even on the pump for that matter. But for every 10 gallons of gas you put in your car, you pay an extra penny. And since Americans buy 178 million gallons of gas a day, that's $500 million more a year. So why do they still do it? Because they can.
People come in here and they see the price. Oh, $18.5 for gasoline. Oh, that's tremendous. I wish it was that way today.
Ed says the price of gas is the hottest topic in his museum. But there's a big misconception out there.
And if you take just inflation alone, yeah, gasoline would be about $2.20 now. But you used to get 10 miles to the gallon. And now we're averaging over 20 miles to the gallon. Nobody likes to hear that.
Thanks, Ed.
Well, after our long virtual road trip, it's time to drop off our listeners and head back home.
Happy motoring.
Bye-bye. Might as well turn this up. I'm Tommy Andres for Marketplace. Brighter than a lucky penny
when you're near the raindrops disappear. We're always looking for fodder for this series. Your questions for I've Always Wondered. You can see the whole series and write to us at marketplace.org. Coming up,
You know, you're standing up there and you kind of switch gears from wine to beer, and you see a lot of puzzled looks from person to person and eyes widening at the prices that we were achieving.
And I do mean prices, people, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial has lifted 105 points today, two-thirds of 1%, closed at 16,209. The NASDAQ hiked at 29.7 tenths of 1%, ended things at 4,292, while the S&P 500 stepped up 14 points, three-quarters percent, closed at 1,850. Two of the biggest gainers came courtesy of a big technology merger. RF Microdevices sizzled up 20% today, 20%, after it announced a deal to buy TriQuint Semiconductor. TriQuint bounced 26% higher on that news. Healthcare brightened as well. The news that cuts to Medicare look as though they won't be as bad as many had feared. Humana bipped 10% higher. United Healthcare pumped up 3% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.74%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, a Senate committee holds a hearing on examining mental health, treatment options, and trends. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And let's take a look at the cans in your pantry. Peaches? Green beans? Chocolate pudding? February is National Canned Food Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Department of Homeland Security has put out a help wanted sign of sorts. It's asking private contractors to come up with what is basically the holy grail of air travel today, a machine that can speed up screening times. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Since 9/11, the time it takes to process passengers through airport security has more than doubled, so says Perry Flint at the International Air Transport Association. Flint notes that more people are flying as well.
You can see the problem is that lines will get longer. So the industry is well aware of this, and governments are well aware of this.
Including Homeland Security, which is asking companies to come up with technology they call screen and walk, preferably a machine where passengers don't have to take off coats, shoes, jackets, jewelry. Sounds like something money could buy, right?
That's called the silver bullet. And to be honest, it doesn't exist.
Douglas Laird is a former security chief for Northwest Airlines. He says there's still an awful lot of R&D needed before they come up with technology that will allow passengers to just glide through security. Richard Bloom at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University says in the end, faster security lines will come from technology paired with better intelligence.
Otherwise, we'll be screening in a faster way, a better way, about people and things that really don't pose a significant threat. There'll be more danger to the general public, not less.
That's why the airlines hope the TSA can quickly expand its budding pre-check program, where flyers can get 5 years of expedited security checks in exchange for a background check, their fingerprints, and $85. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We're starting a series this week about people and ideas that have changed the way business is done. We're going to call it The Innovators. And this week, we're going to spend some time on African-American innovators, men and women who turned their industries upside down. First up, Frederick McKinley Jones, also known as the Thermo King. WYSO's Lewis Wallace has the story.
Frederick McKinley Jones' big break started with a truckload of chickens. Minnesota, summer 1938. As the story goes, Jones' business partner, Joe Nimero, was out with a buddy in the shipping industry who got a chilling call.
News came in right around the time that they were playing golf that he had just lost a whole carload of chickens, actually.
This is refrigeration historian Bern Nagengast.
The trip took longer than it was supposed to, and the chickens overheated and died.
Joe Nimero, who was this kind of cocky entrepreneur, said, "I bet I can come up with a solid refrigeration system that can handle these long-distance trips." So he went to his partner, Fred Jones.
And presented him with the problem and said, "What can you do?"
Within weeks, Nagengast says, Jones had invented the refrigerated semi-truck. Together, Jones and Nimero started what's now known as Thermo King, one of the biggest commercial fridge companies in the world. Fred Jones took out 60 patents in his lifetime, and he was born in the 1890s, so he was pretty much self-taught. Growing up, he figured out how to fix watches, then cars, and eventually made his way to Minnesota, where he invented a cheap way to synchronize sounds and pictures in movie theaters. That's how he hooked up with Joe Numero. The pair switched to refrigerators because that's where the money was. The trucks were popular. They were even used in World War II to ship medical equipment and blood.
Any contributions that African Americans made before the Civil Rights Movement was really minimized.
That's journalist and historian Yvonne Laddie.
That generation of African Americans were completely disrespected, yet they moved forward and did things like he did. They invented.
And Jones was a rare inventor. He stayed in Minneapolis as the chief engineer of Thermo King until he died in 1961. Bernd Nagengast says to refrigerator engineers, Jones is a total rock star.
He really was a genius in my mind.
But his legacy isn't quite so well preserved back in his hometown.
We are in Covington, Kentucky.
This is Dan Gleer. He runs a breakfast sausage company that's used refrigeration since 1946, just a few years after Jones perfected refrigerator trucks. Sure enough, he has a fleet of two Thermo Kings.
It's just like a big, giant refrigerator.
The driver, Will McCall, opens up a truck to show off its temperature control. But these guys have never heard of Fred Jones.
So he's the mastermind.
Yeah, we didn't know we had him.
Yeah.
It's clear enough to them. Without Fred Jones, there would be no freezer aisle, no interstate sausage trade, no beer truck, not to mention the most important refrigerated truck of all. In Covington, Kentucky, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
I learned a new word the other day, cicerone, from the Latin meaning guide. Current usage from the craft brewing industry. Think sommelier, but for beer. Michael Moser is one. He works at the Skinner Auction House in Boston, and we called him because tomorrow night there's going to be a live auction there, not just of fine wines as usual, but the finest high-quality ales as well. Michael, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I confess I am astounded to find out that you can get really, really, really high-quality beer at auction. I had no idea this kind of thing happened.
We've been doing it for a couple of years now. We started in November 2012, and it's been growing ever since.
What's it like being up there auctioning off these beers?
It's fascinating. You know, the first time that we had a major offering of beers last May, you know, you're standing up there and you kind of switch gears from wine to beer, and you see a lot of puzzled looks from person to person and eyes widening at the prices that we were achieving. And it's absolutely a ton of fun.
Are there other people doing this, or is it just you guys?
As far as brick-and-mortar auction houses go, it's just us.
Are you the guy who looked around and said, there is money to be made in beer auctions, as opposed to wines, which you have also done in the past?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of connected the dots. It was actually one of the beers that we're offering, Midnight Sun M, was one of the first beers that really caught my eye on the secondary market. Saw that someone had bought it for a pretty penny and figured, you know, while we're doing wine, why not throw some beer in there as well?
Yeah, so this Midnight Sun M, how much did that go for, pretty penny-wise?
Well, we have it in the auction for $1,200 to $1,800.
Get out of here. That's a bottle of beer?
Single bottle of beer.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Have you had any?
I have not.
Wow, that's kind of amazing. And as everybody who listens to this program knows, I'm a big beer guy. I really like beer. But holy cow, that's a lot of money for a beer.
And that's not even the most expensive one.
Yeah, I'm not even going to go there. who's buying these?
You know, it's everybody. We've got, I mean, everybody who's a fan of beer, really. Not everybody.
Yeah, except me, because clearly I'm a cheapskate. I don't know.
No, it's, you know, private collectors, people who are doing little private tastings with a group. So sometimes you'll get people pool their money together and buy a special bottle to have as the centerpiece of a tasting. Even restaurants are getting in on it.
What is it that makes a beer auction worthy, if you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, what we're looking at in terms of what we want to offer, it's not necessarily, you know, the most highly regarded beers in the world, although these are extremely highly regarded. They're beers that will age, that, you know, can survive 5, 10, 15, 20, or even more years in the bottle.
If you could go out, though, and just drink a beer, what would your beer be? Would it be one of the ones at auction tonight?
I mean, those are largely, you know, beers that you want to sit down and ponder. But if, you know, if it's the end of the day, I mean, I'll drink pretty much anything. I'll look to Jack's Abbey as a nice local beer out here. Open up one of those and give it a shot.
Michael Mosier, he is at the Skinner Auction House in Boston, Mass. Michael, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Guy.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, perhaps the very definition of what Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. There was a time in this economy when this was the very essence of high tech.
Hello and welcome to Movie Phone.
Dialing 777-FILM, F-I-L-M, to get movie times and to buy tickets. Well, I am sorry to have to tell you that the New York Times reports that after 25 glorious years, Movie Phone is shutting down. AOL, which bought Movie Phone for a kind of amazing $388 million 15 years ago, is going to pull the plug pending a rebranding, we are told. I have no idea what that is going to look like. But for now, that's it. We got to go. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.